My name is Tim Camps, and I am a recovering middle school teacher. That's why I just come and hang out. I can't actually teach. I just come and hang out because I was a teacher for 11 years, and then I was director of technology at Holland Christian Schools for 15 years. And then 6 years ago, I started my own company doing consulting, mostly with schools related to technology. And one of the things that we did at Holland Christian during my time there was back in 2005, we started a one-to-one program with our middle school students. And at the time, that was kind of an unheard of thing in West Michigan. Very few schools were doing that in the state of Michigan, even nationally. We wanted to go visit schools that were doing it just to see what it looked like. And I think we had to go to Cleveland, and you know there were like multiple states, but it, you know, required like plane trips to go to see these schools who were doing it at the time. And now. You know, it's hard to find a school that's not putting devices in the hand of every kid, if not all day long, at least for significant portions of the day, if not taking them home, you know, they at least have them on carts and they're available. So that kind of landscape has radically changed over the time period. But one of the things that I loved to do when I was at Holland Christian is we would have schools come and visit us and take a look at what we were doing and how we felt it was making a difference in teaching and learning. Because that was our goal, was to change teaching and learning. And we felt that the technology could be the catalyst to help us to do that. And so we would have schools come and visit and ask questions and visit classrooms and talk to students and look and see how the technology was working. Sometimes it was the tech people and they wanted to see the back end and how did it all work. And sometimes, you know, it was that middle school teacher who said, I just don't know what I would do if I walked in and all my students had a device and they would just, you know, do chaos and would take over the room and I don't know how I could control that. And so putting their minds at ease and helping them see how that might work was a really interesting and fun part of my job. Like I said, about 6 years ago, I decided, gee, it'd be kind of fun to see if I could do that as a living and go out and work with schools. So that's what I do. I spend most of my time working with schools, helping them, whether it's big picture stuff, looking at how to implement the technology, helping them with choosing technology, the infrastructure that goes in to make sure that it works. Because the last thing you want if you're a teacher is to have 7 different lesson plans depending on which technology is working or not working that day, right? If you want to talk about a killer in terms of morale and enthusiasm for changing teaching and learning, you know, have Wi-Fi that doesn't work enough of the time that it's unreliable, or your internet goes down enough of the time that, you know, you can't get all the kids on to whatever website it happens to be that you wanted to use that day, those kinds of things. And so I spend time talking about those kinds of things, but also work with schools and helping them to implement, think through what that looks like in the classroom, help them think through in terms of curriculum, digital citizenship, and those kinds of areas. So we're going to kind of walk through. Hopefully this won't be a kind of a downer session. I've got some frustrations with the way I see things going on right now, but hopefully we'll find some resources and some things that might help us get us moving in a direction that I think would benefit and would really help in terms of changing teaching and learning. Just a show of hands, how many of you are in a school now where your student has a device of their own that they either provided by the school or that they bring? And do they take them home? So they stay at school, middle school, high school, middle school. Okay, so sometimes that changes at levels, and usually kind of that middle school is that range where they start taking them home. High school usually do, elementary often they're left at school. How many of you have been in that situation of a student having a device like that of their own to use for more than 3 years? More than 5 years? More than 10 years? Yeah, no, I get you guys. So it's for a lot of us, it's a relatively new thing. In the last, you know, we've been building up, we've been buying carts and putting laptops or Chromebooks or iPads on carts and sharing them around and trying to make that work, and then finding out that that ends up being kind of a frustration because the teachers who really want to use it can't get it enough, and the ones who you'd like to have them start trying to use it just use it as an excuse not to use it because, you know, it's not available when they happen to need it for their particular session. So this is actually, I don't know if you know this, but one of the first one-to-one programs was a one-to-one typewriter program, and it was a correspondence school. It was also a distance learning at the same time. So you would send away for the course materials, you would buy a typewriter, and then you would learn how to become a secretary via correspondence school. So if you watch British shows like Down Abbey, you learn things like that. But anyway, this just was a cool picture. And but why do we exist as schools? What's our purpose?
To prepare students
to what?
Productive members of society.
Productive members of society, okay? So that's a big pillar, right? We want them to be contributing productive members of society. What else?
Change agents
within the culture, right? We talked about what's the theme for this year, CEA?
For the life of the world.
For the life of the world, right? About how do we help our students, yep, you win the prize, toss them the candy. How do we help our students become change agents, agents of renewal in the world that will reflect glory upon God? And how do we do that as Christian schools? And how does technology then, in my realm, as I think about it, and as you're seeing in your schools, all this technology showing up, how does the technology play a role in helping you do that? Or does it inhibit you? Does it make it more difficult for you to do that? Right? Because it's not necessarily always going to be a positive thing. Could be a negative thing. Again, depending on how it's used.
As a Spanish teacher,
yeah.
Google Translate seems to be what the kids want to go to do all of their assignments.
And why not? It's so easy, right? So how do you develop your assignments that take into account these tools that they have the ability to just go look it up, plug in the information, and it kicks back out the answers, right? You know, that's a tough one, but, you know, there's lots of areas where if you said, you know, if I can Google this, should it be on a test? Should it be something that I require my kids to memorize or learn if it's Googleable? I don't know. Maybe not. Probably not. There's probably a lot of those things that we used to spend a lot of time teaching kids vocabulary and other kinds of things, facts about history and battles and being able to, you know what year something happened or somebody was born in. Who cares? You know, are we looking at the bigger picture, the theme of God's story within that history? So it does. It presents that challenge. So these are my goals for our session. We've got a fairly small group. Some of you are going to have to move in a little bit when we do a little talking. We're going to have to just talk loud, which is fine too. I want to provide some context. I want to provide some framework. We're going to have a little discussion. And then I'm going to provide some resources for next steps. So you got to kind of stick around to the end to get to the next steps and some of those resources. That's the carrot. How many of you have heard of common sense? A couple of you? A few of you? Okay. If you have never visited commonsense.org, I highly recommend it. There's a whole section that was originally developed for parents. And now there's a whole education section for it, and they just provide incredible resources for parents and schools to help them think about how do I use technology in a way, and to think about maybe some of the pitfalls and how do I avoid those. So one of the things that I wanted to do was take a look and use their website to talk about how technology is changing childhood. And so they kind of have a good way of talking about that. They've been around for about 15 years, so their original goal was really looking at media, television, movies, those kinds of things. They were trying to provide resources to help parents that would guide them to find good quality materials that parents could use and allow their children to take part in. And then as the digital landscape changed, so did theirs. There's a couple stats in here. By 2007, 50% of homes had internet broadband, compared to 7 years earlier, where only 3% had broadband internet. At Holland Christian, we started our middle school program, one-to-one, in 2005, and that was one of the concerns we had at the time, was that everybody had internet at home that they could access to be able to get to continue doing their homework, to access the websites, to work on the tutorials, to do the flipped classroom kinds of things that we were trying to do at the time. And some of the folks, you know, lived in places where there only was dial-up. And so, you know, that made it very difficult and challenging for those early years for some of those students, that especially those that lived out in the country where it was more difficult. You know, now that sort of is mostly ubiquitous. Pretty much anywhere you go, you have access. Although, you know, even with your phone, maybe you run into some dead spots once in a while. But there are very few homes that don't have it. I thought this kind of timeline was kind of interesting because it intersects with some of the things that we were doing. Some of you are probably old enough to remember MySpace. You know, that was a big social media. The first Facebook, 2003, 2005, YouTube launches, Twitter launches the next year, Gmail, Google Apps launches the next year, 2006, and that was one of those invitation-only things. You needed to know somebody who could send you an invite to join. 2006, Facebook allows users over the age of 13 to join. It went from being kind of this college social network to being the social network, or started to become that. Netflix starts streaming in 2007. If you remember that broadband statistic, you needed to have broadband in order to do Netflix. And then I think one of the seminal moments in terms of technology was 2007 when Apple released their iPhone. And I think that sort of changed the game sort of forever. We went from having these dumb phones that we mostly used for phone calls and maybe did a little bit of texting with to these pocket computers that could have apps and had the internet on them, and you know, you could get a wolf from Alfra on there. You, I mean, it was just unlimited the types of things that you could do with them. Now, they were, you know, still kind of slow at the time, and the internet speeds weren't that fast. But this was kind of that first big change where that idea of having a device with you all the time that had those capabilities really came into being. And then, of course, 2007, Facebook had to figure out how they were going to make money, because up until this point, they weren't doing anything with advertising. Hard to believe, but at one time they didn't. And so they opened their business up for businesses and advertisers to now, instead of the product being Facebook, the product became Jonathan, right? Because now they want Jonathan to come back. And so if Jonathan's on Facebook, every once in a while they're going to nudge him and say, oh, don't you remember 4 years ago you were here and you did this thing and you posted these pictures? And don't you want to reshare that with all your friends? And in the meantime, you know, we've got some ads and things that we want to show you. And you've been, you know, searching for some camping gear. And so now all of a sudden all this camping gear is showing up everywhere on every website that you go to. And you're trying to figure out why that is, because there's all these little morsels called cookies that are tracking you all over the place. I like the quote. So here we are conducting the world's greatest experiment on our kids in real time, and we don't know how it's going to turn out. For those of you that are in middle school and high school, I would be surprised if it wasn't 85 or 90% of your students walked around with a device like this. At least they have it with them. Maybe they're not allowed to have it out during the school day, but they've got one. They have access to it. They're looking for ways to try to get access to it during the day if you have policies about that, or if you haven't figured out ways to make use of them using it for educational reasons. But it's a little bit like all the technology we're putting into schools. We're spending billions of dollars putting all of these devices in the hands of our kids, and we don't really have a good sense of how that's going to turn out. We don't have any good models of what's been done in the past, because education's been done a certain way for a really, really long time. The Industrial Revolution time period and that factory model of cranking out, maybe productive citizens who could add, subtract, and could follow orders and work in a factory and go to a job where they would have the same job from the time they graduated high school until they retired, or maybe they would change jobs a couple times, or maybe they would go to, you know, grad school and become a lawyer or a doctor or something else. But today, that's very different. So then we start working into these areas of cyberbullying and things that for some of us who are a little older, didn't have to deal with when we were, you know, other than notes that somebody left you in your locker. But it certainly was a lot different than the kind of cyberbullying that goes on now with these devices. And schools having to react and how to think about that. How do we work through helping our students understand how to be a good digital citizen? How many of your, just by a show of hands, how many of your schools have a digital citizenship curriculum that's written down? Okay, and that's not surprising. That's pretty typical. We talk a lot about digital citizenship. And when we talk to our parents about we're putting these tools in their hands and we want them to be good digital citizens, and then we kind of scratch our heads and go, boy, how are we going to do that? Like, For some of us, we didn't have to deal with it when we were in school, and so it's such a foreign thing to us. And if we're a little younger, you know, we kind of know some of the pitfalls, and we deal with them, maybe some of it in our own lives or our kids' lives. But we don't have a good sense of how do we do that with our kids, and how do we do it in an intentional way, and how do we do it in an integrated way, right? So it's not just layered on. We don't send them to that, you know, two-week sex ed class. So we have the one-week digital citizenship class, and everybody takes their digital citizenship class, and when they're done, they get their little certificate, and now I'm a good digital citizen because I've learned everything I need to know in order to do that. And we know as teachers that during that 1 week or 2 week or whatever it happens to be, that the likelihood of that teachable moment happening during that time period is pretty darn low. And it just becomes something that gets kind of layered on and kind of goes over the kids' heads, and it doesn't connect with what they're doing, doesn't connect with real life. So we've got states that are adopting saying it's important, they're adopting curriculums, they're writing stuff about, you know, what that could look like, but we don't have a lot of it happening in schools on an intentional basis. It happens here or there. Teachers look for ways, and they see an example, and they maybe talk it over with their team when there's an issue of cyberbullying going on, and that brings up a discussion that happens in class, but there's no sort of intentional kind of a program in place to help them do that. Just some other quick facts. YouTube, by 2009, 1 billion views per day. And MySpace starts to disappear. 2010, we're the first to start to think about the fact that we're tracking, kids are getting tracked. Right? When Google first opened up some of their tools, there were a lot of fears about when they opened them up to schools, are they going to be tracking our kids? And Google said, no, we don't do that. And then it was kind of like, well, yeah, we sort of do, we sort of don't. And they've had that on a number of occasions where that's come up, where they've said, no, we don't do that. And then with whatever new device it happens to be, it turns out that, well, in fact, yes, they do. You know, the time that our, for those of you that have young children, the amount of screen time or access to mobile devices, you know, that's changed significantly. Used to be you'd buy those high-end minivans, so you had the little video player, you know, on the back of the seat, and now you just hand them the iPad, right? And that keeps them busy on the long trip. They got all their movies to watch. They're starting to build some movement for the ability to erase. I think that's a bit of a pipe dream. We talk about, you know, what you put online, that having that eraser button that you could just go in and click sounds like a great idea. I just think it's going to be really hard for them to figure out a way to make that happen. The number of apps, we talked about the iPhone, over 1 million apps available. This one was kind of interesting to me. 2014, that the number of mobile devices in the world surpassed the number of people in the world. So I've got an iPhone, I've got a laptop, I've got an iPad. If I looked around my house, I could probably find a couple other devices that get used semi-infrequently. If we look at developing countries, the cell phone or a low-end smartphone is the device of choice, right? Because they do all their banking on it. They can do, you know, pretty much anything through their phones. And so that idea of these mobile devices outnumbering the number of people we have in the world is a bit of a shock, at least to me. Some schools, probably not a lot of the schools that we deal with, have that digital divide of the haves and the have-nots, where they live in certain areas and then socioeconomic backgrounds where they don't have the resources to have the high-speed broadband, to have the devices at home. And so providing resources for those as well. Again, just some more things that Common Sense has been working on over the years. In 2016, they introduced the concept of a device-free dinner. How many of you struggle with device-free dinners? Just me? Wow. You guys are awesome. Your kids are going to be awesome, too, I can tell. It has become such a part of our own lives that being able to separate ourselves and being able to shut down and put those things away has become such a challenge for adults, and we're supposed to be modeling that for our kids. And evidently, just me has that problem here. But here's this one's a little shocking. I'd like to see their research on it. 2017, kids spend 9 hours a day with media and tech, and so do their parents. The parents must be the binge watching, right? Whatever that episode is, whatever that show is. Again, just some more stats, just showing that we're getting to the point where nearly everyone has access to those devices. And now we're dealing with things like augmented reality and virtual reality, and whether those things are, is what are real experiences that we're having? Are they, if it's taking place there, is that a real experience? Are we able to separate those things? Are we able to understand the impact of something that might happen on in a virtual world can be just as impactful as in the physical world? So here's a little ad that I thought highlights some of those changes.
Mm-hmm. Why do you only have photos of Danny on the wall?
Well, when you were born, we had Facebook. So you're tagged in all mommy's Facebook photos.
Okay.
I know that I, as a parent, don't have nearly as many pictures. I probably have something like, 20 or 30,000 pictures on my phone. And I know that I have a whole lot more pictures of my grandkids here than I do anywhere else in my house. And I don't, even think about the fact I do try to have some artwork and some of those kinds of things. What I'd like you to do is just take a moment and turn around or next to the person next to you or across the aisle. I want you to share with them one positive change that you've seen with technology over the last 15 years. It could be personal or it could be educational. And one negative thing that you've experienced. So one positive, one negative. Turn around, find the person next to you or across the aisle from you.
I have a question. I don't know if they got it right.
Do I need to know that kind of detail, or is it looking at the story
story, God's story throughout time, and seeing what were the movements, what were the themes, why was the Civil War, what was going on, why was the Civil War, what were the reasons for that? Why were states rising up and saying, no, you can't tell us what we can or cannot do? So if I can Google it for the test, is it something that should be on the test? Right? So it makes us kind of have to rethink what's important. What do our kids really need to know? And what do we want them? Is it this thin little layer across the top, stretching across all of this different stuff? Or do we want to give them opportunities to take deep dives into things that they may find that they're passionate about, and yet still help us accomplish the standards and the things that we're trying to teach and the things that they need to know, but tapping into their interests, giving them the ability to be unique in the way in which they demonstrate their learning and their understanding, right? We can accommodate, we can differentiate. How about over here?
We've said that for negative, like phones and personal devices, can be kind of like an escape from social situations, and it's acceptable to just be on your phone as opposed to like interacting face to face with people. And then positive, some of those same things that have been said, like communicating with family members that are far away, and traveling becomes easier because you can research and know what you're doing and that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. I would say probably for me, a couple things. Personally, I have had an Apple Watch since they first came out. And for me, even though I may not look like it, the activity part is really important to me. It's one of those things that motivates me. I look at it and I go, oh man, I got to get moving. I got to get up and start walking around and doing some things. And then I get notifications from some of my friends who just completed their fifth workout for the day. And, I feel jealous and angry and sad. And but it reminds me when I need to get up. I've been sitting for too long. I got to get up and move around. Or it's time to pause and do some breathing exercises. You must be a little tense. And the watch can sense that I'm a little tense. So to me, that's a really positive thing. The Facebook piece I struggle with because I love to see cool things that are happening. I just became a grandparent for the third time, so seeing new pictures, being able to keep track of family and friends who live in different places, or people who are going on trips and being able to see things that they're able to experience. And yet at the same time, I find for myself, I tend to go on and post when my wife and I are able to travel, either because of her work or my work or points we've earned, and we go someplace, and then we post a bunch of pictures about that, and then I kind of feel guilty because it's like, oh, look, I'm just showing, this is like the cool side of Tim. Tim goes on these trips, and he shares these trips, but it doesn't talk about Tim struggling with this or Tim having an issue with his family and, something that really needs prayer about. Tim's using it as a way of kind of making Tim look the best. This is the best Tim that's possible. And so personally, that's something that I struggle with. So it's one of those things that has just a huge impact in our life. And if we look at the picture here in this list of companies, whether it's that instant gratification of click buy now, and I can either have it 2 days for free, or I can pay $3.99 and get it tomorrow, makes me want to buy things. Makes me actually probably spend more money than I would spend on things, those impulse purchases, because I don't have to worry about getting in the car, I don't have to drive over to the store, I can go online and research it, I can read reviews, and then I can just click and it shows up at my house. Google, we talk about some of the privacy kinds of things. of putting our data out there. Facebook, we all know between Facebook and Twitter in the last election cycle and all the Twitter bots that were out there that were promoting fake news about different things, about the advertising and the news that was going on Facebook and all of these fake accounts that were getting created. For some of us, we already, because we work in Christian schools, operate in a little bit of a bubble. You know, we don't necessarily see what goes on in other schools, and we don't see that. But it happens even more so, I think, sometimes in Facebook, where the group of friends that we're with, we tend to be friends with them because we think the same way about things. And so we post stuff back and forth about things that we agree with them about, and they agree with us about, and they like it, and we like the things they do. But then there's this whole other group of people who we never interact with, who have a different way of looking at things. And so it's almost, I don't say almost, I think it's driving a wedge and becoming a way of being a tool that becomes very divisive, because we're just in our own little echo chamber. Right? We talk about these things, and all the people we talk to all agree with us. Whether they're next door or in the classroom next to us, or they're 1,000 miles away, but they're people who agree with us. And so those are the people we associate ourselves with. And then the people who don't, we don't associate with them at all. And then we can't understand how they could possibly have a different idea than us about whatever the topic might be. So lots of challenges there, and what are we doing to help our students think through those things? What are we doing to help our students understand the privacy issues, the devices that are always listening to us, about what's true and what's not when we're reading things online? So this big promise when all of these technology companies started coming out with these devices and said, hey, we can help you change teaching and learning, what's happened to that promise? Because I think for a lot of places that I see decisions that get made based on what is the best tool for taking an online test. And that's how they decide what device to buy for their students. It's the best test-taking device, and so that's the device we're going to buy. And so it has almost nothing to do with teaching and learning, but it has everything to do with what's going to make it easiest for us to take these high-stakes online tests that if we don't pass and get a certain score on, our school's going to get put on some watch list, or we're going to have parents that are going to be upset with us, those kinds of things. And for those of us that have been doing it for a while, and we think, hey, we're doing a pretty good job with it, we've got a lot of technology in our classrooms, and we think our kids are using it in good ways, how do we measure that? What are the ways in which we're looking at it and evaluating it? And so that technology integration piece of taking that technology and integrating it into our teaching and learning. Some schools have people with that word in their name. They've hired people in the last number of years to be technology integration specialists, right? That's their job, is to help teachers think about how to do that. And that idea of integrating, for me, I like this last, just to form, coordinate, blend into a functioning or unified whole. That without that piece, it wouldn't be whole. We couldn't do, if we're really fulfilling the promise, it's allowing us to do things that otherwise would not be whole, would not be complete. And I think that's the challenge and that's the goal. So I'm going to run through a few frameworks. How many of you have heard of TPACK before? Okay? Here's a quick little video that will help you understand a little bit about that concept, how that framework works.
You're a teacher ready to tap students into 21st century learning, but teaching with technology adds a whole new layer of knowledge and expertise. TPAC, or Technological Pedagogical Content Knowledge, is a framework that helps teachers consider how their knowledge domains intersect in order to effectively teach and engage students with technology. It's an approach that looks at the combination of what teachers know, how they teach, and the role of technology in order to better impact student learning. So, how does TPAC work? First, consider three domains: content knowledge, pedagogical knowledge, and technological knowledge. Content knowledge, CK, is the what, your understanding and expertise of the subject area you teach, whether it's science, social studies, math, language arts, or all of the core curricular areas. CK is made up of all the facts, concepts, and theories of any given discipline. Pedagogical knowledge, PK, is the how, your expert knowledge of the art and science of teaching, from learning theories to instructional design. PK includes methods of teaching and assessment, like project-based learning, as well as instructional strategies like think, pair, share. Knowledge of these principles helps you design successful learning experiences for each individual student. Pedagogical content knowledge, or PCK, is the intersection of the pedagogical and content areas, the knowledge you have of how to effectively engage students in learning concepts and skills. This knowledge includes approaches for addressing different learning styles and scaffolding content for deeper understanding. Educational psychologist Lee Shulman saw this intersection as teaching at its best. But several scholars, including Matthew Kohler and Punya Mishra, have added an additional component to 21st century teaching, technological knowledge, or TK. TK represents your knowledge about the tools, including how to select, use, and integrate technology into your curriculum. But it's not just about the devices. It's also the quality of content that students access through apps, websites, and games for learning. By integrating technology into PCK, you now have new insights into and opportunities for student learning. Technological content knowledge, or TCK, refers to how technology is used in a subject area for deep and lasting learning. For instance, to further their understanding of a topic, budding scientists can use sophisticated tools to collect evidence, make observations, and document findings. Interactive software then allows them to see their data represented in various ways. Application of such technologies can help deepen individual students' inquiry within a given discipline. Technological Pedagogical Knowledge, or TPK, is your understanding of how to choose and manage technology for your students. For instance, what technology will best ease your students' workflow throughout their exploration of the scientific method? How can you use collaboration tools to have students share their learning with each other? This knowledge about technology will advance your teaching. The intersection of all three knowledge domains, content, pedagogy, and technology, is the core of TPAC. This center area refers to your understanding of how tools can enhance your teaching and support student learning more deeply and effectively. For example, when learning about water pollution, students could explore 3D models of bacteria's cellular structure and then create their own animated images to analyze local water sources. They then could share their findings virtually with a prominent field expert. This dynamic interplay of all three components is TPAC, the heart of innovative teaching. You can use the TPAC framework to assess your own knowledge of content, pedagogy, and technology. Consider which areas you feel confident about and which areas you can improve upon. But also think about how you can collaborate with others at your school or in your professional learning communities to combine your strengths. For example, you could meet with your technology coordinator to brainstorm ways to redesign learning experiences. And knowing that each student, each teacher, and each classroom differs, the dotted line around the framework symbolizes the context that affects how TPAC is applied in a practical sense. TPAC takes into account that every classroom context is unique due to variations in professional development, school climate, and available resources. In conclusion, the TPAC will help you remember to start with your content and pedagogy, and then layer in technology, Sometimes we get excited about a new technology, and then we design a lesson around that particular tool. But in doing so, it's easy to lose sight of goals and objectives for student learning. TPACK reminds us that technology is just part of great teaching. It's truly an intricate combination of content, pedagogy, and technology that make for innovative teaching and learning. So, what does your TPACK look like?
Okay, does that make sense? You've got those different kind of areas, and you probably can all think of a teacher who was really, really knowledgeable about a subject, but had a really hard time conveying that in a way that you could understand. And you might have had a teacher who was a really great teacher, but their understanding of the subject matter might have been a bit limited, and you might have been more advanced in some areas than your teacher even was in that. Or you have a teacher who, boy, they know the technology, but they just don't have the pedagogy skills. And so, you know, classroom becomes just sort of a chaos, and there isn't a lot of teaching and learning that goes on because they don't have that skill set in each of those areas. So that's kind of one framework of looking at it. This is another one that was from some of my friends up in Canada at some of the Christian schools in Ontario. They look at it in a little more holistic kind of way. They still have the pedagogy, the mastery of content, but their focus is on the connected relationships. And I would say if there's one thing that's probably changed in a lot of our schools over the last 5 to 10 years is the focus on building relationships. I think that that's been something that's been important, relationships, whether that's student to teacher or student to student or outside of the classroom itself. And then the other pieces that go in to help that all work together is kind of the environment, whether that's the technology or whether that's teaching and learning spaces, maybe it's furniture, maybe it's different classroom arrangements that allow you to do that, that create that environment where that can flourish. The next framework that I'm going to quickly share with you is the SAMR model. How many of you have heard of the SAMR model? Okay, a couple of you. Again, we're talking about moving down a path or bouncing back and forth between different regions, starting out kind of at that substitution level. When we first got that technology, what did we do? We took all of our worksheets and we digitized them. So now they were electronic worksheets. So if we had them looking up information in a book and filling out a worksheet, now they were going online and finding the information and filling out that same worksheet, right? There was no functional teacher still is kind of in charge, very teacher-directed. It's the same, just using technology to do it. Augmentation starts to make it a little bit easier, a little bit more effective, modification, and then redefinition, and that's the area that we want to go to. And this is a video created by some kids and a colleague of mine that focuses and kind of explains that.
Can help students learn. How can our teachers reflect on how effectively they're using technology?
Well, that's what this model is for, the SAMR model. It's kind of like a Bloom's taxonomy for educators.
It was created by this guy, Dr. Ruben Fuentedora, who believes that using technology allows us to think differently and perform new tasks.
After all, if we have today's technology, then why teach like we did 20 years ago?
There's 4 different levels and 2 different sections in SAMR.
Let's take a look at the first level, substitution.
This is where the technology used acts as a direct substitute. Let's take the task of persuasive essay writing. I could write an essay by hand, or I could type an essay using the basic features of a word processing program.
The task is the same, and there's no functional change. The technology is being used as a substitute.
Lots of teachers start out at this level, but don't worry, because substitution is not a bad thing.
Even the best teachers visit this level from time to time.
The next level is called augmentation. This is where the task is still the same, but the tech allows for some sort of functional improvement. So instead of writing our persuasive essay on paper, we could use a program like Google Docs.
With this software, the task is still the same, but the unique features of a collaborative document provide some functional improvement.
In both these levels, the technology is used to simply enhance a lesson. This technology may make tasks more efficient, but it's not likely to make a big difference in future outcomes. Most learning takes place above the line, and it starts with modification.
Here, the technology is used to provide a significant task redesign.
So instead of simply writing an essay, a student can publish a WordPress blog using text and embedded videos, pictures, and other web links to convey their argument. The audience is no longer just the teacher, either.
It's the entire world.
People from anywhere with an internet connection could review or comment on their writing, allowing for deeper analysis.
The final level of the ultimate goal of technology integration is redefinition.
Here, the technology allows for the creation of new tasks that were previously inconceivable. Instead of writing that essay, students could now create and publish a digital storytelling project to argue their writing with multimedia.
Plus, just like the blog, through publishing this movie to the world, it allows for other people to comment and analyze their message.
So the heart of the assignment is still the same, but the technology allows them to engage in a new, more involved task that's otherwise not possible.
At these levels, learning is transformed through the use of technology. When we are more engaged and involved, significant improvements in learning are more likely to take place.
Different people have different ideas about SAMR. Some think that SAMR is like a long-term climb. You start a substitution and work your way up to redefinition.
Others think each level is like a swimming pool that you swim in or visit from time to time throughout the school year, and that's okay.
Because no matter the interpretation, the real power of the framework is that it promotes reflective teaching in the classroom. What you do, why you do it, and how it helps learning.
By thinking about the different levels, teachers can focus on designing digital learning experiences that will help improve student outcomes.
See, the thing about SAMR is this. It's not the type of tech tool that defines the level. It's how the individual teacher uses it in their lesson.
So whether you're substituting or redefining learning,
remember the ultimate outcome for integrating technology should be simple.
Maximizing student success.
Want more information on SAMR? Check out these links.
So we've got some frameworks that we can use to kind of help us think through how that technology is getting integrated or whether how well it's getting integrated. We also have some research that's been done in terms of what does a meaningful learning environment look like. According to their research, it needs to be active, constructive, goal-directed, authentic, and collaborative. And if you think about some of the different examples that were shown in those last couple videos, you can think about how do you get your students becoming more active in the classroom, that it's more of a constructivist approach, there's more goal direction involved, they know what the end is supposed to look like, it's an authentic learning experience where maybe they're interacting with other people, outside experts, bringing experts in, maybe presenting their information to a public audience, and then the collaborative piece in terms of working together. And so, you know, we want those kids to be active. We want them to be constructing things. We want them to have those goals and be directive in terms of that. Authentic, that idea of having a real purpose and real meaning for why they're doing it. And then the collaboration piece. Because we know that the world that we grow up in now, the world that our kids are going to be going into, is going to continue to change. The types of jobs that they're going to have is very different from the jobs that you or your parents had, and that they're going to probably change several times. And it's the skills that we give them to learn, to continue to learn, to know how to collaborate, to know how to work effectively together, to be goal-directed, all of those kinds of things are what's going to help them to be successful. This is just another little framework. If you've never been to EdSurge, it's another website that I would recommend. It's on the resources that I'll share in just a minute. I'm just about done. I have one quick little video that I want to share about, do we have any fans of The Office here? Okay, so maybe you've seen this episode.
not. Time will tell. I'll tell you one thing to the kid Mexicans. Never endanger anybody's lives. Inside match. What? Got it.
So, humorous, but to the point, we've got this technology, we've got, how do we take that next step to avoid being killed by the technology, and yet allow that technology to help us build those connections, to build those human relations with each other. This is the resource that I put together, so the only thing that you really need to know is, if you've used Bitly before, it's just CEA Next. And if you go to bit.ly/CEA next, you'll find a whole set of resources. So if you're interested in some of those frameworks, looking at evaluating your school in terms of some of those models, there's stuff for that. Collaborative kinds of resources, learning management, project-based learning, and then digital citizenship. Again, Common Sense Media's got a lot of things. Anybody familiar with Protect Young Eyes? Okay. That's another one I would consider, I would encourage you to take a look at. They've got resources for schools and churches, but they've got a whole curriculum that goes through that. So with that, I'll just put that back up there in case you didn't get a chance to write that down. Feel free to come up and talk to me. I'd love to visit your school, talk to you about what's going on, and if there's any way that I can be able to help, I'd love to do that. So thanks for sticking around.